For what's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The two U.S. presidential candidates took part in a national debate late Sunday at Washington University in St. Louis. They clashed over a number of issues, including Islamist violence on U.S. soil. The first to speak, Republican nominee Donald Trump.
We have to be sure that Muslims come in and report when they see something going on. When they see hatred going on, they have to report it. As an example, in San Bernardino, many people saw the bombs all over the apartment of the two people that killed 14 and wounded many, many people. Muslims have to report the problems when they see them.
His Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton, shot back that that was short-sighted and demagogic.
We need American Muslims to be part of our eyes and ears on our front lines. I've worked with a lot of different Muslim groups around America. I've met with a lot of them, and I've heard how important it is for them to feel that they are wanted and included and part of our country, part of our homeland security, and that's what I want to see.
Trump apologized for crude remarks about women made 11 years ago in a video released last week. He accused former President Bill Clinton of being abusive toward women. Clinton said the audio revealed who Donald Trump really is. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has pledged more support in the fight against drug and people smuggling. In the first stop of an African tour that began in Mali, Ms. Merkel is also expected to focus on the implementation of a peace agreement reached more than a year ago between Tuareg separatists, other armed groups, and the Malian government. Germany has hundreds of troops in Mali as part of a UN peacekeeping operation. Berlin is also helping train border security officials to fight extremists. Ms. Merkel, scheduled to visit Niger and Ethiopia, is also searching for ways to stem the flow of migrants to Europe. This is VOA News. Thousands of marchers took to the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a Sunday, protesting an apparent Saudi-led coalition airstrike that killed more than 140 people, including prominent pro-Iranian Houthi officials, at a funeral Saturday. Hundreds were wounded. The protesters, some armed with weapons, gathered outside the UN offices of Sana'a, chanting death to Al Saud, the Saudi royal family. Riyadh has launched an investigation into what now calls a regrettable and painful incident. University of New South Wales analyst Anthony Billingsley sees little doubt the Saudis were behind the strike.
The fact that there were some senior Houthis in the audience, probably they had some sort of intelligence that they'd be there. The Saudis have, I think, been targeting civilian targets all the way through this conflict. I note that I think it's Human Rights Watch, for example, commented that perhaps a third of all the casualties have been civilians.
The Saudi-led coalition of regional Sunni governments has been attacking Houthi rebels in Yemen in support of President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi since March of last year. A Palestinian was killed after he opened fire from a car in Jerusalem Sunday, killing a woman, pedestrian, and a policeman. Six others were wounded. The attacker identified as a member of the Hamas militant group with a long police record. A Syrian Islamist group, Jund al-Aqsa, said it's pledging allegiance to the former al-Qaeda branch, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, in a bid to end infighting that threatens rebel unity against the forces of President Bashar al-Assad. But it continues to battle with another powerful Arar al-Sham group in northern Syria. Jund al-Aqsa is on the U.S. State Department's list of terrorist groups. In Haiti, 3 days of national mourning are underway following the loss of hundreds and widespread devastation caused by Hurricane Matthew. Southern Haiti was especially hard hit. John Hassey is National Director for the Humanitarian Agency, World Vision in Port-au-Prince. He said the southwest of Haiti, which sustained almost total devastation, was not the only region affected.
Some other hard hits are areas are like Lagunav, the island in the middle. The western side took a really hard blow. 50% of the houses are destroyed there as well. And then the northwest as well, that's not getting a lot of attention, but what we're hearing from our partners that work there is it's also just extremely hard hit.
Matthew, which buffeted the U.S. East Coast, causing billions in damage, lost its hurricane status and has weakened to a post-tropical cyclone. Georgia's generally pro-Western ruling party, the Georgian Dream Party, won parliamentary elections, according to results released Sunday following Saturday's vote. In Myanmar, at least 9 policemen killed, several wounded, in multiple assaults Sunday on border guard posts near Bangladesh. Ghana's main opposition leader, Nana Akufo-Addo, has launched an attack on the government's economic record during a mass rally Sunday ahead of scheduled December 7th elections. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today's Monday, October 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have had their second presidential debate.
I didn't think I'd say this, but I'm going to say it. And I hate to say it, but if I win, I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation.
That's Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump on Hillary Clinton's email scandal. Ugandan police arrest opposition leader Kizza Besigye and the Lord Mayor of Kampala. National dialogue enters a crucial phase today in Sudan. And Ethiopia declares a state of emergency over anti-government protests.
The state of emergency is declared to address security challenges we have been facing in many parts of the country, which we believe cannot be addressed through ordinary law enforcement measures.
Getachew Reda is Ethiopian government communications minister. Public boarding schools in Nigeria's Borno state are set to reopen today, Monday, and inaccuracy of diabetes tests. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and Democratic Party candidate Hillary Clinton have had their second of three debates. The candidates disagree on U.S. policy on Syria. First, Donald Trump.
She talks tough against Russia, but our nuclear program has fallen way behind, and they've gone wild with their nuclear program. Not good. Our government shouldn't have allowed that to happen. Russia is new in terms of nuclear. We are old, we're tired, we're exhausted in terms of nuclear. A very bad thing. Now, she talks tough. She talks really tough against Putin and against Assad. She talks in favor of the rebels. She doesn't even know who the rebels are. You know, every time we take rebels, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else, we're arming people. And you know what happens? They end up being worse than the people. Look at what she did in Libya with Gaddafi. Gaddafi's out. It's a mess.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton also addressed the Syria conflict.
Well, the situation in Syria is catastrophic. And every day that goes by, we see the results of the regime by Assad in partnership with the Iranians on the ground, the Russians in the air, bombarding places, in particular Aleppo, where they're are hundreds of thousands of people, probably about 250,000 still left. And there is a determined effort by the Russian Air Force to destroy Aleppo in order to eliminate the last of the Syrian rebels who were really holding out against the Assad regime. Russia hasn't paid any attention to ISIS. They're interested in keeping Assad in power. So I, when I was Secretary of State, advocated, and I advocate today, a no-fly zone and safe zones. We need some leverage with the Russians because they're not going to come to the negotiating table for a diplomatic resolution unless there is some leverage over them.
Mr. Trump said if he's elected president, he will appoint a special prosecutor to investigate Hillary Clinton's 33,000 missing emails.
But when you talk about apology, I think the one that you should really be apologizing for and the thing that you should be apologizing for are the 33,000 emails that you deleted and that you acid washed. And then the two boxes of emails and other things last week that were taken from an office and are now missing. And I'll tell you what, I didn't think I'd say this, but I'm going to say it. And I hate to say it, but if I win, I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation, because there has never been so many lies, so much deception. There has never been anything like it. And we're going to have a special prosecutor. When I speak, I go out and speak, the people of this country are furious. In my opinion, the people that have been long-term workers at the FBI are furious. There has never been anything like this where emails and you get a subpoena. You get a subpoena, and after getting the subpoena, you delete 33,000 emails.
Clinton again said she had made a mistake by setting up a private email server.
Well, Martha, first let me say, and I've said it before, but I'll repeat it because I want everyone to hear it. That was a mistake, and I take responsibility for using a personal email account. Obviously, if I were to do it over again, I would not. I'm not making any excuses. It was a mistake, and I am very sorry about that. But I think it's also important to point out where there are some misleading accusations from critics and others. After a year-long investigation, there is no evidence that anyone hacked the server I was using, and there is no evidence that anyone can point to at all. Anyone who says otherwise has no basis that any classified material ended up in the wrong hands. I take classified materials very seriously.
That was former Secretary of State and Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speaking during last night's second presidential debate. You also heard Republican Party candidate Donald Trump. The Ethiopian government has announced a six-month state of emergency in response to deadly anti-government protests across the country. Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn said Sunday in a televised address that the declaration was intended to curb recent attacks. Getachew Reda, Ethiopia's government communication minister, says the protests pose a threat against the people.
The state of emergency is declared to address security challenges we have been facing in many parts of the country, which we believe cannot be addressed through ordinary law enforcement measures, because we believe the actors who are involved in using violence to achieve whatever end they say they are interested to achieve are doing it in a manner that targets civilians, targets critical infrastructure, targets investments in this country. And, of course, this is being done with the support and coordination of Ethiopia's historic enemies. And, of course, this calls for an extraordinary measure to deal with, because the ordinary techniques of law enforcement are found to be wanting. This is what the Constitution clearly provides for. And, of course, that's why we have declared a state of emergency.
What do you say to the opposition people? They claim that they are not even being allowed to protest and that the security forces now are going to have too much power.
The security forces will only have power sufficient enough to address this challenge, because civilians are being targeted, infrastructures are being targeted. We have organized gangs, violent gangs, armed gangs roaming the streets, the towns and the cities across Ethiopia, destroying properties, terrorizing the public. And, of course, the security forces should be empowered in such a manner that they will be able to address this challenge and bring normalcy to the lives of people. Now people are being terrorized by organized gangs who are trying to take advantage of people's legitimate protests to pursue agenda that has nothing to do with the people. It has nothing to do with Ethiopia. And, of course, this is being orchestrated, being carried out at the behest of external forces who are hell-bent on destroying this country.
I'm interested in, though, you said by being assisted by external forces. Does your government have any proof of some foreign country involvement?
We have tons of it, and we'll have proper channels to disclose this information, this evidence.
Getachew Reda is Ethiopia's government communications minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Addis Ababa. A leading Ethiopian opposition figure says the government's declaration of a state of emergency indicates the government has lost control of the political situation on the ground. The government Sunday announced a six-month state of emergency in response to increasing and deadly anti-government protests across the country. Professor Beyani Petros, chairman of the Ethiopian Federal Democratic United Forum, a coalition of four opposition political parties, says the state of emergency is actually a reinforcement of the government's treatment of the opposition.
This is something which we have been expecting, since the government totally lost control of the political situation on the ground. So I don't believe it will add, as far as using heavy hand against the population that is protesting is concerned. They have been taking these actions with impunity. and are killing hundreds and imprisoning and thousands and all that. It's just simply the format. They're just being formal and declaring the state of emergency that, as far as we are concerned, this has been already there.
The government said that the state of emergency is necessary to deal with what the government is calling anti-peace elements that have allied with foreign forces to jeopardize the peace and security of the country.
This is typical of all the oppressive governments in Ethiopia, starting from the days of Haile Selassie, and then the Derg and these guys. This is seeking some kind of excuse or to externalize, the legitimate opposition of the population. They always invoke this. So this is not, any specific description. And I think the population has been mobilized and been protesting these external hands or anti-peace elements. That kind of thing is an old chorus. So it really does not go any distance to describe what has been going on in Ethiopia.
What do you say when the government says that some of the protesters have destroyed factories, vehicles, burned and damaged a lot of property? So what do you say to that?
Well, my organization does not condone that. It's unfortunate that the legitimate opposition, which is peacefully operating in this country, and my organization being the major opposition, we have been prevented, operating or leading the population so that it can express, legitimate demands or express opposition. But we have been denied to hold even town hall meetings, let alone demonstrations. So the population, coming out of the last year's so-called, election, which the ruling party declared that won 100%, the population has been seriously angered, enraged, and just took only small or rather very limited actions of the government to trigger off such massive opposition. So, as I say, these public protests were not led by any legitimate political party. The population just took the matter in its own hands, and there was no way we could even influence and even advise protests. We are for, peaceful demonstrations or even disobedience, not for destruction of property and what have you.
Professor Beyene Petros is chairman of the Ethiopian Federal Democratic Unity Forum, a coalition of four opposition political parties. He was speaking with me from the capital, Addis Ababa. Public boarding schools in Nigeria's Borno State are slated to reopen today, Monday. The schools were shut 3 years ago amid attacks and threats from militant group Boko Haram. The government says security has improved enough to reopen most of the schools. Chika Odua has more from Maiduguri.
On Monday, 17-year-old Abdul Kadir Abdullahi will put on his new pair of shoes. He'll stuff his new textbooks inside his brand new book bag. He's going back to school. For almost 3 years, things have not actually been interesting because we have not been going to school. We were really sad about it, but there was nothing we could do. He will be attending an all-boys government boarding school in the Borno State capital of Maiduguri. For a few years, the school had been converted into a camp, taken over by people who had run to Maiduguri to escape Boko Haram. But these days, Boko Haram's violence is not as rampant as it was previously. So the state education commissioner, Inua Kubo, said it was time to reopen the schools.
Now that the peace has gradually returned and we have relocated all these IDPs in the schools, we are going to reopen on the 10th of October. Well, generally, everybody can attest to the fact that, unlike before, you see, I don't know when last we had a bomb blast anywhere across the state. It has taken quite some time.
In a bid to destroy Western-style education, Boko Haram has directly targeted schools across northeastern Nigeria for the past 7 years. The sex attack in the town of Chibok in southern Borno received the most attention. In 2014, Boko Haram members invaded the town's secondary school and kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls. The school campus was virtually destroyed. A Borno state government official told VOA on Friday that the school will reopen, although many Chibok families have relocated to other areas and the school's campus is still being reconstructed. For the time being, he says, students will use classrooms in the primary school. Teachers across the state say they are excited to welcome back their students. Baba Goni Ibrahim has been teaching science at an all-girls high school in Maiduguri for the past 20 years. He knows that many of his students will struggle to get back into the classroom routine, having been away for almost 3 years.
We have to tie up our belts and make sure that we double up our effort teaching the afternoon and morning. We'll give them a rigorous training to catch up. If not, actually, they are left behind.
All the same, Abdul Qadir Abdullahi says he is happy. He had been spending his days working as a tailor. Starting Monday, he will spend his days as a high school student. Chika Odua for VOA News in Maiduguri.
Ugandan police Sunday arrested opposition leader Kizza Besigye and the Lord Mayor of Kampala, Erias Lukwago. President of the Forum for Democratic Change, it's Mugisha Mutu.
He was arrested in the morning and also the Member of Parliament for Makindye, the area where we were supposed to hold Erwaria as the opposition. And basically the regime is scared of a comparison between the crowds that they would have drawn in the area where they were going to hold the independence celebrations, which is about 2 hours from the capital. Our rally was supposed to be here in the capital, so they suppressed our rally, and that's why they arrested Dr. Kizza Besigye when he was leaving his home and the Member of Parliament in the area where we're going to hold the rally.
Did the police say why he was arrested? I'm assuming that the government does not want you to have a parallel independence rally.
He just refused him to get out of his home. And eventually they picked him and took him to Nagarama. That's a police station normally where the politicians, they take them there for a day when they are disrupting our activities and then they leave them at night. It's a practice of the police. It's just one of the repressive methods that they use in terms of disrupting our activity as the opposition.
The government said, as the government of the country, it reserved that right to hold Independence Day festivities.
They don't have a right to stop anybody else who wants to celebrate in whatever other area they want to celebrate. Nobody would stop them doing whatever they do. But they do not have the right to stop anybody else who wants to celebrate the day in a different area.
So what can you tell us? Has Dr. Besigye been released since his arrest on Sunday? Was he released?
The practice has been that they normally do so at night, but I haven't got information yet. I was waiting for someone to give me a call.
We know that Dr. Besigye was taken off the plane when he arrived in Uganda. Was there any explanation why that happened?
Again, they didn't want him to go through the city, so they picked him from the tarmac at the airport and they rushed him straight away to his home. They never wanted him to go through town because they didn't want processions.
The government's claim is that there are flyers being circulated and people are referring to Dr. Besigye, the president in waiting. What does the FDC make of that?
Anybody can have people meet them. I know they see people who are coming from pilgrimage. Some of those who come from Mecca, they are those who go to Rome for pilgrimage. They come and relatives, friends go and meet them. Anybody can choose to go and meet whoever they want to meet. So there's absolutely nothing illegal in that. The problem is that when it's something political, that's when the regime out of panic. They don't want to see where crowds gather when it's a political activity, and that's the very reason why they suppress such activities.
It seems since the February election, the FDC has been involved. Dr. Besigye particularly has been involved in some kind of civil disobedience. How long does your party intend to carry that out?
Civil disobedience is a legitimate method of expressing discontent by the population. It doesn't have to be by only politicians. It can be on any issue, social, political, economic. And of course, as we see the way the economy is on a downward trend, I suspect that there are going to be quite a number of civil disobedience activities, not only from us as political parties, but I suspect from workers, from as we've been seeing from the universities.
Mugisha Mutu is president of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change Political Party of Uganda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. In Sudan, national dialogue enters a very crucial phase today, Monday. Agme Bilal is the Minister of Information and Government spokesman.
Actually, today we had a meeting, a general conference of the dialogue. We reached the final recommendation which had been agreed on. Total agreement between all the people to whom they joined the dialogue. 14 extra parties have been joined. Dialogue. The number of all the parties in Sudan now, 89 parties plus 34 movements have been joined the dialogue. All these recommendations have been agreed upon. And another thing, actually, we signed the national charter today. In fact, and practically, the dialogue is finished today. Tomorrow we will have a meeting, which is almost a ceremonial meeting, whereby we are going to receive some of the guests from different parts of the continent. One of them is from Mauritania as president of the Arab League, and from Chad, the president of the AU, and Yoweri Museveni from Uganda, participant of also in the dialogue. And are going to receive the Egyptian president as a neighbor. And this will be just a ceremonial meeting tomorrow, and we declare the final by signing of the president that he receives recommendations. This will be the end of the dialogue.
As you know, Minister, the purpose of the dialogue is to chart a way forward for Sudan. What is next? Is your government willing to create a government of national unity with the opposition?
Yes, actually, this is going to take place in 3 or 4 months, the coming next month. After comprehensive meetings and talks between all these parts, the national government secured these recommendations, and some of the recommendations actually have been divided. Some of them need to be actually applied, an amendment in the present constitution. Some need some sort of amendment in the laws or creation of new laws. Some need actually a presidential decree.
Minister, the Umar Party is not part of this dialogue, are they? The Umar Party?
Actually, part of Umar Party have joined. Mubarak al-Fadil al-Mahdi, one of the leaders of Umar Party, he joined. And we received also a letter from Sadiq al-Mahdi agreeing about all the recommendations. He said this is the best thing, but for the others to sign later on. But he is agreeing about all the recommendations.
Minister, what can you tell us about the doctors' strike that's been going on in your country?
In fact, actually, this is now diminishing now. Most of the states, the strike is over. I think they have a genuine case because they are being subjected to attacks from the people and these things for the doctors and for some mistakes which have been carried out, or some of the hospitals are not very well equipped. And this is so, and we are doing our best. This is almost over now.
Agme Bilal is Minister of Information and Government Spokesman of Sudan. You're speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. And that is it for this Monday, October 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very productive week.
On the next Trade Talk Africa, political talks in the Democratic Republic of Congo have resumed after being suspended weeks ago following 2 days of deadly protests on the streets of Kinshasa. We'll discuss the latest developments in the DRC next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
VOA. On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.